When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast, where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr. With me, as always, Brian Reese.
Hey, Paul, what's happening?
Not much. Just excited to talk about an old comic book with interesting undertones.
We're here to support the military-industrial complex.
Absolutely. So to explain that last little bit, today on the program, we'll be discussing A Real American Hero. G.I. Joe.
Yo, Joe.
We'll be discussing G.I. Joe, the original run from the 1980s. But first, what would you like to talk about first, Brian? The show or the other thing?
Let's lead with the show.
Okay.
So, because then the other topic is a good transition.
Yes, it is. It's almost like we know what we're doing.
I'm helping.
Yeah. At the time of this recording, the last episode of Loki just aired a few days ago.
Bad.
I didn't think there was going to be a second season. So that little post-credit stinger made me happy.
Well, they almost had to. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not like they didn't completely leave us hanging.
Yeah, but I assumed that would be wrapped up in other movies and other shows.
Right, but the movie that would wrap up in isn't for another 2 or 3 years, right?
I'm pretty sure Doctor Strange comes out next year, but don't quote me on that. Anywho, Loki, pretty good series, if I say so myself.
Yeah, no, I thought it was, it's not quite WandaVision.
I was thinking the same thing. I was trying to put my rankings. There's only been three shows right now. Right, yeah. But I definitely think WandaVision was the best. It was more innovative and experimental.
Right.
And although I really liked Falcon and Winter Soldier, it's definitely the most straightforward of the three shows so far.
Right. And I think Loki is, the whole Time Bureau or whatever, the TVA is pretty great. I mean, just that concept is great. And of course, visually, it's phenomenal, right? It just looks so good. And of course, Tom Hiddleston is great. And Owen Wilson.
Owen Wilson's great.
Good for stinking Owen Wilson, right?
Yeah, just wow. He didn't say wow throughout the entire series, but he did have one line where he said, "We got to do it now."
And I think I'm with most people where, we all wanted this series to end with him on a jet ski, right? I mean.
Yeah, eventually he's going to be on a jet ski. I've seen so much fan art of he and Loki on a jet ski.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if Marvel doesn't give us Mobius on a jet ski, I think, you know, there will be a riot.
I guess the one thing we got from this final episode is, of course, the introduction of Kang, although he's not called Kang in the episode.
Although he does. It's great. You know, it's like, I've been called a conqueror.
Yeah. And he is he who remains in the original Timekeeper's storyline, that's who was at the end of time, was he who remains. So nice to see that the writers are, they know their content.
Well, and I think this is a very, the whole Kang, Immortus, all of this, you know, it's this extremely convoluted. It's almost, you need a degree, I think, to keep up and a really good memory to keep up with the whole Kang timeline and...
It just seems like over the years, every time there was a time-traveling guy, Rama Tut, it was Kang. Franklin Richards, it's Kang. Which is another thing. He does mention he's a scientist from the 31st century, which is one of the Richards, Reed Richards' descendants. Lots of little seeds being planted for future storylines.
You know, but I think the writers, let's hope they can get it streamlined enough for the average viewer. And I consider myself like one of those so that we, you know, we're not completely lost, but we'll see what they do with it all. It has the potential to be a lot of fun. It has the potential to leave people walking out of a theater scratching their heads.
Yes, because I mean, you and I are both comics literate and we know a lot of the history, but even that, I had to look up a couple of things about Kang because it's just so convoluted and confusing, his whole story. But we know that Kang's going to be in Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania. I do like the fact that what we see in Loki is Kang, but it's not Kang. So, just the idea of all the different variants.
Right, right. And then, which apparently we're going to have unleashed upon the timeline.
Yes. They opened a Kang of Worms.
Have you been waiting for that?
It has been puttering around in the back of my mind.
I think it was a great series, and I really enjoyed it. And I think, with apologies to the Hiddlestonies, are they is that right for the Tom, like the Bronies, only the Hiddlestonies?
Sure.
Richard E. Grant is now officially the greatest Loki of all time.
Not the alligator?
Not the alligator. Not Kid Loki. No, no, it's Richard Grant.
Fair enough. Well, what about...
Come on. I mean, that was awesome.
No, he was great. Don't get me wrong. He was fantastic. And the comics accurate costume, absolutely brilliant. It takes an actor of his caliber to be able to pull off that outfit.
Right. Or not pull it off in a way that it's pulled off. There's probably some kind of weird innuendo there as well that I'm just going to leave alone.
Everyone in this was just great. I mean, Sylvie, the actress who played Sylvie, who I am blanking on right now, but she was great. Kid Loki was great. Definitely setting up Young Avengers. Every show so far has had a younger version of a already established character.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, because we get Wanda and Vision's kids.
Yeah, and then the Isaiah Bradley's nephew in Falcon and Winter Soldier.
Falcon and Winter Soldier, yeah.
Yeah, so, and then, of course, Florence Pugh's character in Black Widow. Yeah, we're gonna have a young event. Oh, and then, of course, Kate Bishop in Hawkeye is coming up.
Okay.
And Ms. Marvel, Kamala Khan.
What do we have next? What is it? Is it What If? Is What If next?
What If is next, and then I believe it's the Hawkeye? Hawkeye? I believe it's the Hawkeye series after that.
A lot cooler if his name was Hawkeye.
He's from Canada, plays a lot of hockey. He couldn't stick to it, so he got the puck out of there.
Oh, jeez.
To wrap up this whole Loki, we're not going deep into the Loki thing, but boy, that was an entertaining series. And the fact that the MCU is still just planning ahead, and I think the brilliance of it is they plant enough seeds and they throw out enough information that they still have the wiggle room to retcon things.
If a global pandemic happened and things were delayed,
they're still putting out really good series, but now with Disney money. But now let's transition,
shall we?
Yes. So of course we're going to be talking about the G.I. Joe comic from the 1980s, which brings us to inevitably toys.
Yay, toys!
Yeah. Well, this was a series based on a toy line, as was the tradition in the 80s. You know, you couldn't have a cartoon without it based on a toy line. I mean, it really transformed children's television. Yeah. But, and maybe you can attest to this, Brian, you're a bit younger than me, but I am a gentleman of a certain age. So, but my G.I. Joe toys, which I did have, were the 12-inch, fully articulated, fuzzy-haired G.I. Joes.
Yeah, no, I had those... I got, like, I must have been 5 or 6, and someone, like, donated a box of toys to me and, like, a family member or family friend or something, and it was filled with the 12-inch G.I. Joes. So those were my first G.I. Joe toys. I think I was starting to get Star Wars at that point, too, but, you know, of course, I played with them, and I did yours have the, where you'd pull the string, and I've got a tough assignment.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yes. There's a snake in my boot. No, yes, I think I had 3 of them. I know I had the OG I Joe. Yeah, he was the one with the fuzzy head and the fuzzy beard. But I know I had Sailor Joe, and I had a third one which I cannot remember.
I can't remember. I think I had 2 or 3 as well, but I feel like I had a cowboy. Was there a cowboy one?
No, that was the Village People.
Or was that a I remember that box was full of like cool stuff, and I even got the Jeep.
Yes. Oh yeah, I had a Jeep as well.
And you know, imagine if I hadn't played with those, but carefully, you know, put them in the closet and preserved them.
Yeah.
I'd be rich.
I had, like I said, had G.I. Joes, but I also had the $6 Million Man line.
I had the six. I just had $6 Million Man. That's the only one I had from that.
Yeah, but there was a robot that came, like a guy with a face that came off, and I had Evel Knievel. My Evel Knievel doll would had a little little wind up thing. You put the motorcycle in, you wound it up, pressed a button, and it shot off.
See, now I didn't have Evel Knievel. I had Team America. Do you remember Team America?
America. Yeah.
Which was the same concept.
Right.
You know, it was, but it was like a few years later, and there was a Snake Eyes type character on Team America, and there was a comic book for it too.
Yeah, I vaguely remember Team America, to be honest with you. Yeah. I remember it, but I don't have vivid memories of it. The other toy I had was Rin Tin Tin. Yeah, it was a big old German Shepherd that you could move around. But the reason I mention all this is because they all joined the same team. It was G.I. Joe, $6 Million Man,
Evel Knievel,
and Rin Tin Tin. They were all on a team that did special missions together.
Well, yeah, same, you know. And then, of course, later on, right, so, of course, we were both Star Wars kids. So, I got tons of the Star Wars toys at this time. And I was young enough that I was still getting toys like when G.I. Joe first started.
Okay.
And so I was getting like the G.I. Joe toys, like, you know, Snake Eyes, obviously. And I think I even had that Fortress.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And Masters of the Universe. So I would have, I mean, when I was like 5, 6, 7, me and the neighborhood kids would all get together. And we just had like the G or the Star Wars toys, and we'd have neighborhood battles with all of our various Star Wars toys. Eventually, I moved away from that neighborhood, and I was in an area where there weren't a lot of kids my age. And so I had to do these by myself, but I would have, it was the original G.I. Joes, the Team America, G.I. Joe, the new G.I. Joes, Star Wars, and Master of the Universe would all be in battle together.
Yes.
Well, and I had Castle Grayskull. So it's like, you know, Castle Grayskull, I remember, would be mobile. So it would like go after the Fortress.
it did have a face on it. Yeah.
I had Grayskull, I had the Fortress, and I had the Death Star. I had all three things kind of lined up, and
that actually sounds awesome. I remember, though, being slightly disappointed when the Star Wars toys came out. The reason being, because I had all these big old figures. Plus, I had, you know, I don't know how many of the Mego dolls.
Right, right.
Yeah, I had a ton of those. And then when the little tiny plastic ones came out, I was like, and they're all stiff. And I was like, they're okay. Right. I, of course, quickly got over that and collected every single one I possibly could. But I do remember that just slight little kid's disappointment of, that's it. Like I said, got over that
really
real quick.
Crappy, and the really crappy lightsabers that...
Yeah, Luke, that kind of slid out of the arm.
Yeah, Luke, Ben, and Darth Vader had.
Yeah.
Yeah, now you look at these toys and they have like 500 points of articulation. Yeah. It's a slight exaggeration, but you know, it's just... Back when we were kids, we only had 5 points of articulation. We liked it. We liked it.
Yeah, we were happy. We took what we got and we enjoyed it. And I had to walk uphill both ways just to get my toys.
In the snow,
which is year round.
Right.
I think toys are better now than they ever were. Well, not ever were.
Nowadays with their 500 points of articulation.
I really loved my G.I. Joes. Yeah, with the Kung Fu grip, which really, I mean, it really was a selling point that the hands could grip, but it really made no difference.
No.
You know, it was just...
Yeah. It was an extra thing where you're like, oh, this does this.
And they can shake hands. Look how cool that is.
In the Death Star, they have the elevator that goes up and down.
I had all the Star Trek Mego dolls and the bridge and the bridge of the Enterprise. Of course, there was a transporter on one side, which was like you just shoved your doll in there and then just twisted it. And they popped out the back. it was ridiculous. You know, it was ridiculous and it was cheap. But I loved it.
Well, sure. You know, I mean, yeah. Stinking kids, you know.
But yeah, I mean, do you have anything else to say about that? We did our little reminiscing about toys. This comic book that we're about to read or talk about, it was so heavily based on how can we sell toys. It is a testament to the writers to say, how can we make a story and still sell toys at the same time?
Which I believe we will get into.
Shall we just do that?
Let's do that. Okay. But let's take a break first.
Good idea. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about a real American comic.
Woo!
And we're back. Brian, today's... Please do that. Today's comic is your recommendation. Today's comic is your recommendation. Tell us all about it.
All right. I certainly will, and I'm happy to. In the early 80s, Hasbro, noticing the success of Kenner's Star Wars toy line, decided to relaunch its G.I. Joe line for a new generation of happy youngsters. Branded a real American hero, Hasbro engaged in a multimedia, for the time, blitz, that conveniently included talking Marvel Comics into publishing an ongoing G.I. Joe comic. The purpose, of course, was to tap into the comic reading public and use said comic to push personal narratives of the characters and, naturally, be a source of constant new product rollout. A perfect synergy of capitalism, the military-industrial complex, and entertainment. But would it really be sustainable? Enter Larry Hama, a military vet and comics writer and editor. Tasked with writing the comic, Hama was also in constant consultation with Hasbro, helping to create new characters and their backgrounds within and without the book. And Hama had some tricks up his sleeve. The first 12 issues or so were engaging enough to create the intended buzz, and sales were extremely hearty. These issues followed closely to a pattern of introduction and action, with the individual Joes being given enough page time to demonstrate their unique skills in military action while being given standalone personalities. Hama certainly had his favorites, Stalker, Scarlet, Clutch, and perennial fan favorite Snake Eyes. And he was beginning to show something suggesting a longer view rather than one-and-done product placement bits. Issues 2 and 10, which introduce Quinn and the town of Springfield, respectively, contained some solid storytelling that went beyond the more generic tropes of a military comic. And the timely for the time, 7th and 8th issues, tackled the Russian invasion of Afghanistan and gave us the Soviet version of the Joes, the October Guard. With issue 12, Hama hits fully the stride that would make this book a massive seller that would last for 155 issues in its original run. From the Banana Republic nations of Rio Lindo and Sierra Gordo to attacks on the nation's capital, from Coney Island in Miami to the Army Chaplain's Assistant School in Fort Wadsworth, Hama creates an insanely rich and complex chess game, utilizing the serialized soap opera nature of comics to forge something that had to be far beyond Hasbro and Marvel's wettest dreams. Hama is a master. With a through line of a mysterious toxin serum, we are treated to a globe-trotting adventure. Cobra gets fully fleshed out with all the crosses, double crosses, triple crosses that define their villainy, but suggests motivations that are outside the bounds of the merely stereotypical. Gwyn and Snake Eyes embark on one of the best buddy cop road trips in comics. Dr. Venom becomes the character we all hate the most. And through all this, we are given more hints and clues to future issues of G.I. Joe. We talk about world building quite a bit, but Hama might be one of the greatest masters of this. And this might be the least decompressed comic I've ever read. In issue 19, we get a form of closure, or at least closure in one of the many ongoing storylines, and we lose a beloved character. It's a pretty thrilling piece of work. And this, of course, leading to one of the most influential issues of a comic in the Bronze Age, number 21. This shouldn't be a good comic. This should not have lasted as long as it did. But in Larry Hama's hands, we get something that, despite its origins, becomes a cultural phenomenon in the world of comics. So that was kind of it wasn't brief, but covered a small amount of the bases. So Paul, obviously I recommended this. You were reading this, I don't know if it's for the first time or the first time in years. What did you think?
Well, this was the very first time I've just never read G.I. Joe. And I wasn't a big fan of I should rephrase that. I didn't really watch the cartoon either. I mean, G.I. Joe was, at this era, was off my radar. So this is the first time I'm reading it. And I had actually texted you earlier in the week to say I would have to take frequent showers to wash off all the testosterone and propaganda. But once you get past that, it's actually a very entertaining comic. You're absolutely right. Like you said in your introduction, the first 12 issues, it's a tale of two halves, much like the Godzilla run we read recently.
Right.
It took a while to figure out what exactly is this comic and where is it going to go?
Well, I think Hama was tasked with, again, this comic was created just for product placement.
Yeah, exactly. And Marvel, which, well, you know, wasn't doing, you could say that about multiple times in its history, wasn't doing well at this point. They were taking anything they could get. So they got the license to this toy line and absolutely, let's just sell toys.
They were basically like, we'll take the Hasbro money with the assumption. I can't imagine they thought this would turn into what it turned into.
Oh no. I can't imagine that either. I mean, how many issues was it? 155
in its original run. Almost all of them written by Larry Hama. There were guests. I think Trimpy, artist, initially wrote a couple of the early issues.
Once Hama is allowed to start telling longer story arcs and basically find the characters he loved the most and just focus on them, it becomes something you could basically say after issue 12, stop, Hama time.
Thank you.
it becomes something different. And it still has that gung-ho, literally gung-ho.
Literally.
you know, kind of rah-rah, hoorah attitude.
It's a military comic. I mean, it's...
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually kind of surprised at the amount of technical expertise Hama has. I mean, I know he's a vet, but like there's one issue in particular where they're trying to start a plane with only three engines and it's done really well. I mean, they explain to you what they have to do and how they have to jumpstart that engine. And I was just reading it thinking, wow, this is actually really complicated. I mean,
and it's explained really well. It's not, you know, it's not one of those situations where like sometimes in comics, it's the character the traditional character over explaining things.
Right. And it's not technical babble. It's not techno babble, I should say. It's actual, you know, this is what happens. This is how you have to start the engine. And it adds real tension to the proceedings, you know. No, I was very impressed by that. He used military language, which he explains repeatedly.
and some of those military, like we were talking briefly before this too, you know, some of those are, they seem a little silly now, but every time they used a technical military term or an acronym, they would tell us what it meant at the bottom. And some of those, I think you said like AWOL.
Yeah, AWOL, without leave. And I was like, yeah, come on. We've all seen MASH. We know what AWOL means.
But for, you know, 6-7-year-olds, 8-year-olds reading this, which I think was the original intended target, was probably, I would guess, like 6 to 12, maybe.
Yeah, probably.
Somewhere along those lines. Maybe 6 is a little young. But like to me, you know, may not know that. Like FUBAR, I first learned what that meant from G.I. Joe comic. And of course, they didn't, it was... The G.I. Joe comic said it was fouled up beyond all recognition.
It was PG-ified.
Yes. You know, and it took me a few more years till I realized, oh, it's not fouled up.
I had said it because one of the acronyms was ASAP and explains as soon as possible. And I just thought, really? You needed to tell us that? But you did make the point that this was for younger readers. And I'm very much an adult at this point. Yeah, I've... And a lot of what was written in this comic has become commonplace now. Wasn't necessarily at that time. Yeah, the military jargon that's in this comic, you know, you could make an argument that the reason we know it is because it was in this comic.
In some ways. I mean, this is, you know, this comic was selling a boatload. Like, you know, I mean, way beyond what we think of now. People, this is, you know, comics were still, you picked it up in a spinner rack at the IGA or at the 7 and 11 or wherever you got your comics. And I wonder, you know, because numbers are hard to really judge from this time period because they weren't kept track of in the way they are now because there wasn't the monopoly of, or the now dissipating monopoly, Diamond, or, you know, in the direct sale market. But, you know, most of the kids that I knew in grade school and early junior high when I was reading this, they were all reading it too. You know, and that this is still when we would swap comics.
And again, I wasn't reading this at the time, but I knew of its existence. It was everywhere, just from its presence on TV and, like you said, in spinner racks and Kmarts and whatnot. It was everywhere.
One of the interesting things that I did not know this, but in doing a little bit of research on this was the first comic book to have a national television advertisement for the comic book.
Really? Oh, right on.
Yeah. So, and I remember that. I remember the, it was during, you know, after school cartoons or whatever. And this was before the G.I. Joe cartoon dropped. Just was, I remember seeing that and I was like, I got to get that, you know, because I was a kid, you know, I am not a big military guy at this point in my life, but as a kid, you know, growing up in an area of the country where, you know, such things were popular, I was like, oh, that looks awesome, you know, and who's that guy wearing all black and a mask? That guy looks cool. You know, and then of course, the cartoon. We have to talk about the cartoon real quick before we dive in, because the cartoon's terrible.
What do you mean it's terrible?
But as you just referenced, I still cannot read the comic to this day without that voice as Cobra Commander. I can't do it. It's that voice is and always will be in my mind the voice of Cobra Commander.
See, it's funny. I didn't watch the cartoon at that time, but I know all the voices and I sang the theme song earlier. It's so right. Ever present in our culture that I know it. Just, I guess, from osmosis or something.
Well, yeah, it's sort of like I've probably never seen a complete start to finish Seinfeld episode, but I know all of the Seinfeld jokes because they are part of the larger kind of consciousness.
What's the deal with that?
Right. Or, you know, I understand about mastering one's domain.
No soup sometimes for you.
Sometimes you don't get soup. Right. But yeah, with the G.I. Joe, some of it is like a lot of people will know the Yo Joe thing that they always said in the cartoon, which always, even as a kid, irritated me. I was like, that sounds stupid.
But it sticks in your mind. There's a reason they do those stupid things.
And I would also like to, and this is a larger topic as a reference to for later. In the cartoon, of course, nobody died.
It's very A-teamy.
You
know,
you blew up, it's like the A-team. You blew up a plane, and of course, you know, the Cobras are all, they're parachuting out of the plane. You know, and I get it, because it's a cartoon.
Yeah, it's a cartoon for kids, and you don't want mass death everywhere.
Yeah. In the comic, though, this is a very violent comic book.
Yeah, there are, I mean, it's not bloody, but there's a lot of, you know, machine gun death going
on. They shoot to kill. There's nobody parachuting out, unless it's a major character that can't die. Nobody's parachuting out of their plane. Nobody is getting, you know, shot in the foot. And
there's one of the later issues, and, you know, not to skip too far ahead, but just to give an example, Clutch and a Cobra agent are parachuting out of a plane, and Clutch disables the guys, but like they have jetpacks on. He disables it and then crashes him into a plant where he explodes and then makes a quippy remark about, oh, that's what it's like to blow up a... I know, I forget what the exact quip is, but I was like, well, that's cold.
Well, and there's this great scene where they're in Rio Lindo, Sierra Gordo, or one of those places where one of these militia leaders falls into... They built like one of those traps, you know, where you think you're walking across... there's an official word for this, I guess, but, you know, where you think you're walking across solid ground, and of course it opens up into a pit with spikes on it, and one of the guys falls into that. That's brutal. I think it's very interesting that in the cartoon, it's a big no-no. And in the comic, it was just like, no, man, you know, we're killing people off left and right from the get-go.
This is war, damn it. We're killing people.
Well, and it's a military comic. This we'll probably be reiterating that throughout, you know, but I mean, I think, and especially the first, like I said, like the first 11 issues, there are some fascinating things that happen in the first half. So for our purposes today, I don't know if we clarified, we're reading issues 1 through 21. I couldn't find like a collection that really satisfied me. I really felt like we had to get through 21, but I also felt like we couldn't just start in the middle, like, you know, so. Yeah.
So basically what we wanted to do was really just review issue 21, but we had to get there.
But even, I think even as I mentioned early on or in my intro, most of those first 11 issues are just it's character introductions. It's like, there's a battle. Cobra is trying to do a thing and G.I. Joe is trying to stop them. But there's little things that Hama does in there. There's little, it's the Marvel way, right? You know, you introduce like a paragraph or a panel.
Well, you know, in the old days with Stan Lee writing, it was a paragraph.
Well, yeah. But you introduce like a panel or two panels that don't seem to have anything to do with the comic, and you're not, it doesn't pay off till down the line. You know, so like issue two apparently is one of the rarest because they didn't know how successful it was going to be. So they underprinted issue two. I remember that because I had two copies of issue two and I was like, oh, I can sell these. You have this like issue two is it's Larry Hama kind of like establishing who his favorites are, right? I mean, issue two, it's Stalker. It's Snake Eyes, it's Scarlet, and it's Breaker. You know, it's they're in the snow, they're going after Cobra, there's some double crosses, but we're introduced to Quinn, who is a native Alaskan.
Yeah, he's mentioned as Quinn the Eskimo. We're not using that term anymore, but it is based on the Bob Dylan song.
Oh, so, but, you know, we're introduced to Quinn, and it, you know, Quinn turns out to be, you know, he's a bounty hunter or he's a mercenary for hire. You know, he contracts out with Cobra to do one thing. You know, at one point, he tells the Joes after these crosses and double crosses happen, Quinn is basically like, my contract is fulfilled. You know, and he's basically telling them, as a man of honor, I have no reason to stop you from doing X, Y, or Z once my contract is fulfilled.
Yeah, he has his own sense of honor and
right, and he has a code of ethics and, right, and whatnot. And he proved to be, like in that issue, an extremely popular character. And so, and I think Larry Hama enjoyed that character. So we do get to see him again later. And in issues like 7 and 8, which we get the October Guard, which are pretty fun. And we we see them down the line. Like we only see the in the issues we're covering, it's only these two issues, but they certainly play a part down the line. They're kind of fun. They're the Russian version of the Joes. But it also addresses, I keep forgetting, you know, it Hama is referencing real life things, even though he's making up names for places. Right. He's addressing real life politics.
Well, just addressing the invasion of Afghanistan. That was happening at the time.
And he does this great, you know, where he's pitting Cobra against the Russians, against the Joes. It's definitely a more interesting way of writing this stuff than you would expect from a toy comic.
I do want to just real quick to address this, and then we don't have to really dwell on it again. Just about the Quinn thing. There are terms in this comic that were okay at the time, but they're not okay now. And it is steeped in 1980s gender politics, which are kind of awkward.
We could talk about that now, particularly the gender politics, although we may disagree slightly on... Let's talk about Scarlet.
Scarlet's a great character. I like her. But she is constantly being berated by other members of the Joes as...
Particularly Clutch.
Yes. Clutch is an asshole. Let's just say that.
He's probably my least favorite of all the characters. And for some reason, Larry Hama really liked him and kept using him. I don't know why. It's sexual harassment.
Yeah. Constantly, yeah, and being told that she's not good enough because she's a girl, you know, that sort of thing. And then later with the introduction of Cover Girl, I guess we'll get to that. I found that tedious after a while. I get it. She's a female on the team. She's the Smurfette of the G.I. Joes.
Yeah, except that she clearly is one of Hama's favorite characters, and she gives back pretty hardcore.
Yeah, he writes her as competent and one of the leaders of the team. Absolutely. Yeah.
And, you know, she doesn't take the shit. Now, is Hama trying to make a statement? I don't know, you know, but...
See, I see it as this was just at the time. You have to, you know, you can see it in other things like Aliens, where there's a female Marine who's probably the toughest person on the team, but she's constantly berated. You know, I mean, it's just, it's very... And it's not just that. There's so many other movies and TV shows and stories that have that same, I don't know, trope, I guess you'd call it. And again, I just find it tedious.
It's very interesting in the writing, and I agree, it's tedious. It's also probably very realistic. And I understand that we're reading a comic book based on toys in 1982 and military toys, but I would imagine that is certainly So, again, I don't want to read too much into Hama's intent. I'd be willing to bet that that's probably mild compared to what I think a lot of the women serving in the military have had to put up with. I'm not offering that as an excuse.
No, and, you know, Hama, as a vet, would know firsthand what was going on at the time. And that's the only reason I bring that up is just like, you know, I see it, I'm addressing it. Let's focus on the intent of the comic rather than some of maybe the outdated terminology.
And because Scarlet is so damn badass. I mean, it's just, there are incredible, you know, scenes with her. Actually, Scarlet being a badass was one of my bullet points. So I guess we talked about that, but.
Well, no, we can continue. I mean, she's going to come up again many times.
Right. Yes. I think, again, this is the early times in the comic, and then I think issue 10, to pivot briefly, I think issue 10 is also a very interesting comic because it introduces Springfield, a nice little town. Which, of course, is Cobra. The Cobra owns the town, and the kids playing in the video arcade are actually learning how to be Cobra soldiers.
Yeah, it's a little... Hitler Youth Cobra organization.
And this is the issue that introduces us to Dr. Venom. It also is the issue where Scarlet and Breaker, or is it Scarlet and Clutch, are hallucinating. It also introduces Dr. Venom, and it introduces us to Billy, a young kid who is part of the Cobra, or the resistance against Cobra in town. Or is he? Unfortunately, we don't find that out in the issues we're covering now. But it's introducing us to Billy a good 24, 25 issues before Billy becomes something very interesting. But it also features that scene where Dr. Venom is trying to get into Snake Eyes' head.
It's that classic trope of, you know, I have this machine that can see your memories.
Right.
But that actually is fascinating because Snake Eyes blocks this mental manipulation by reliving his trauma.
Right.
And that is amazing. I mean it's tragic, but it's really well done for a kid's comic based on a toy line.
And it also is, we start to get an origin of Snake Eyes. We get like a brief, and that's a big thing. We're starting to see, you know, I don't know if you know this or not, Paul, but there is, in future issues, Snake Eyes does get an origin issues, although it's not complete.
Yeah, well, I know that just from doing a little bit of research on the side. It's issues, I think, 25, 26. I may go read on ahead just to see. It's very, very easy to see why Snake Eyes has become a fan favorite. I mean, without saying a word, he's the most complex character on the team.
Right. He's also, like, you know, the deadliest. You know, yes. there's a scene where Hawk is sending Snake Eyes out to do something, and one of the Joes is like, why, you know, what if they don't come back? And, you know, Hawk is like, well, that's why I sent Snake Eyes. Snake Eyes always comes back. You know, and it's, I mean, they really establish him as kind of the toughest. And I think did you read the letters pages?
A handful, but not all of them, no.
Because it's very interesting, the letters pages, you know, everybody lists their favorite Joes, and lots of different ones get name checked, but Snake Eyes constantly. It makes sense. He's the Han Solo.
Well, yeah, he's the coolest looking. He's the most badass. And he has a complex story. Even with, like I said, he has, especially in the first 12 issues, he has very limited screen time, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
But every time he's on a panel, he stands out and makes an impression.
Yeah. And he also is, he's the one that gets the girl.
That's right.
So, you know, so some of these early issues do feature some interesting things, and you really do. But there are issues where it's just, again, G.I. Joe v. Cobra. They do establish Cobra as often one step ahead.
The Joes are always playing catch up and trying to figure things out when Cobra should be winning. Their plans are pretty good.
But, you know, they kind of do it to themselves like a little bit. And we're about to, we've seen Destro, but we haven't seen his face yet. So he's about to get introduced. Baroness is in it from the beginning. We start to see some of the other Cobra characters being introduced slowly. Some of them we don't get to in these issues. Major Blood, who is just a really stupid character.
Major Blood.
I don't know if anybody likes Major Blood.
You know, Cobra, like we said, their plans are really good. They're always a step ahead of G.I. Joe. But there's so much infighting and jealousy. It's a snake pit. It's a snake pit. And there's so much backbiting. And it's this, you know, ongoing theme of evil loses because evil can't get their crap together.
Yeah. There's a great scene. In my notes, I call it The Last Supper, where it's like Baroness Destro, Major Blood, Scarface, Cobra Commander all having dinner together, which I don't know how that works.
Most of them have their mouths covered.
And Dr. Venom's there. You know, and there's this panel, it's Cobra Commander's just doing his Cobra Commander shtick. And then there's this panel underneath it that shows the thought balloons of each one of the other people. And they're all planning double, triple crosses on each other. And, you know, at the end of it, Cobra Commander's to unity.
And it speaks to the credit to Hama for seeding this all the way through, that they will lose because they're always fighting each other more than they're fighting G.I. Joe. Whereas G.I. Joe is always shown as being on the same page. Even when they're having interpersonal conflicts, they still get it together to work as a team.
But yeah. it's also interesting because he builds up, particularly Destro and Baroness, I think, are extremely compelling, interesting characters, and they continue to be so. So, you know, Hama doesn't, he doesn't give the villains short shrift in terms of developing deeper characterization than one would normally expect.
And can I say, it is Cobra Command and all that, but they really took that snake branding to, they took it and they went with it. their tags are hiss tanks. Everything's snake related. They must have had a good marketing team, is all I'm saying.
The furniture company, which is the front for them, is Arbco.
Yes, which is an anagram for Cobra.
One thing I wanted to point about issue 10, and I think it is a running thing throughout the comic, is humor. There are very humorous things, and they're mixed in, you know, it's not every issue, but Hama certainly puts some funny bits.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about the old couple on the beach. Yeah.
And the couple in the car.
Yeah.
And there is an earlier issue where Stan and Laurel, Laurel and Hardy are also featured. One of my favorite ones is the very end of issue 10. Some of the Joes are coming back from the mission, and they land on Hulk.
Well, and it turns out to be a guy in a Hulk suit.
It's a guy in a Hulk suit, and the last panel is one of them saying, boy, when Marvel puts on a show, they really go all out.
That's right.
That's just one of those. It's just one of those little moments
those little moments are kind of sprinkled throughout the entire comic. Even in really tense, violent, sometimes violent places, you just get this little humorous aside.
But I think the comic really hits its stride. Let's try to focus back in with issue 12, and basically issue 12 and ongoing. This is when, so first of all, I want to ask you, Paul, how well did you follow the serum, toxin, micro dot, antidote, not an antidote, who's poisoned, who's not poisoned, what is the serum for?
Yeah.
How well did you follow all that?
Yeah, it did have a element of more things being added to it to fit the story rather than a coherent storyline all the way through. They have a serum, they want to give it to someone, but but it needs a catalyst. But then it has an antidote. The micro dot thing was funny because it's a false briefing or whatever. Right. I don't know what it was, but then there's a micro dot with more information on it, but that micro dot has planted information,
except
it's not, it's actual real information.
Because Destro switched it out.
It was double crosses upon double crosses.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is fascinating, and he carries this whole thing through, Hama does, through like 7 or 8, 9 issues. You know, at some point we're in Alaska in a pipeline, because maybe they're putting it in the pipeline, but they're not putting it in the pipeline. the Joes think they're putting in the pipeline.
Then there's this whole thing about, you know, let's infect someone and send that person out into the populace to infect everyone else, which is very relevant to what's going on here in modern times. But then that doesn't happen because there's not, it needs a catalyst in order for it to become contagious.
And Venom, Dr. Venom is holding the catalyst, right?
Yeah, so that no one will kill him, basically.
But then he's off on a road trip with Quinn and Snake Eyes, which we'll get to. Like, but then at some point, we're jumping ahead, but nobody cares if we're jumping ahead.
Nah.
So the end result is that they decide they're going to infect Scarface.
Who's a, you know, just a weasel character.
He's just a weasel character. Nobody gives a crap about Scarface. Yeah. Poor guy, you know, but at the same time, his name is Scarface. And his name is Scarface because he has scars on his face.
It begs the question, did he have the name before the scars and he got the scars to live up to his name? Or is it vice versa?
Well, he's just a foot soldier.
Right.
Right. He holds no rank. He looks exactly, he's just like all the other grunts, except he has two scars on his face, but then he gets to sit with Cobra Commander and the High Command.
That's funny in and of itself, because you have all these panels of everybody's with their thought bubbles talking about all their devious schemes and what they're thinking, and it gets to Scarface, and he's just like, I wonder what they're thinking about me.
Right, you know. The end result is, again, jumping ahead, but the end result is that, so finally, this whole serum, toxin, antidote, all of this stuff resolves itself when they're finally like, well, let's just give it to Scarface and let him get captured. The reason, then, that they want to do that is not so they can track Scarface. They're not putting a microchip in Scarface, which might have been easier. The idea is that, so Cobra is always trying to find out where the Joe's secret base is. And so if they figure, well, we'll let Scarface get captured, he's going to have this plague. The Joes will have to shut down their secret base, and they'll, you know, there should be telltale signs around the base that they're in quarantine. And that's how Cobra's going to figure out where the Joes are.
It is remarkable, but you know, you'd think that
I didn't mean that as a compliment.
I know. Well, no, I'm incredulous about it as well. But it could just be that you send them in there and it kills all the Joes because it's supposed to be a deadly plague,
right? But then they're like, you know, they're like, well, we'll kill some of them, but then they'll be quick to quarantine.
And they're going to find all the military people wearing masks and ordering Uber Eats.
But the best part is, it works.
Hey, and if you think about it, everyone in Cobra is actually following good pandemic measures. They're all wearing face coverings. Yeah,
they are all masked.
Yeah.
But also, the best part about it is that it works, except it doesn't, because Scarface, of course, overheard the conversation, because Scarface is always lurking outside of doors listening to conversations.
Yes.
So he hears that they're going to do this to him. He steals from Dr. Venom at some point the cure, the antidote. And so when the Joes capture him, he tells them about it. And he's like, I've got the cure right here. And so the Joes are like, aha, well, we'll let Cobra think that they know where we are, and it is where we are, except it's not really where we are, because we're underground and we're going to build a fortress on top of the ground so that when Cobra destroys it, they're going to think they destroyed.
Yes, but secretly we have Castle Grayskull. the fact is, I think so far, I think twice, maybe three times you've said it works, but it doesn't, but it does. And that can be said multiple times about this comic.
And I'm not really even making fun of it because, again, it's actually really complex. It's a little silly, but it shows that Hama is trying to make something more than just...
He's trying to show that there's plans upon plans upon plans. And yeah, and like you said, that's perfect. It's silly, but it's very compelling. Yeah. I mean, I was not bored reading this comic in any way.
No. I mean, it's like I said, it's this. There is no deconstruction in this at all. There are issues where I think it's the issue on Coney Island. Oh, it's 18, where issue 18. Sorry, I turned away from the mic. It's issue 18 where everybody converges on Coney Island. So all of the Joes Destro, Quinn and Snake Eyes, Dr. Venom, Scarface. Scarface is on Coney Island. That everybody's, you know, it's like Get Carter, only get Scarface. It doesn't end there. They end up in Tripoli. this is probably the least decompressed, most action-packed comic. So much happens in this particular, so much happens in a lot of them, but this one is just bananas. And I mean that in a good way.
Oh, I agree. There's a lot of globetrotting in this too, because there's an issue in San Francisco where there's a car chase on the streets of San Francisco, obviously, and DC. There's something, is it in DC where, I mean, there's this big battle and car chase with armored trucks. And when the whole thing is done, there's just traffic lined up behind them.
Right.
As if they're not going to cordon off the area or anything. There's just people honking their horns going, hey, we have to get to work.
And everybody's complaining. That's why I think Gung Ho gets out and like smashes some guy's car.
Because it's a cobra. To type a car is a cobra.
Right, so right. Yeah. I mean, it's vastly, even if some of the plot lines don't seem to make a lot of sense, it's just fun. And
yeah.
Backtrack a little bit because I wanted to introduce the concept of the toxin and the plague and whatever, because that you know, it's with issues 12 and onward that a lot of this starts to come into play. Issue 12 is when things start getting set in motion, and I think one of the most important things is that Quinn and Snake Eyes are reunited,
and it feels so good.
They get involved with Dr. Venom. You know, at some point, this is when Snake Eyes and Quinn and Dr. Venom end up in this bunker that the Baroness blows up, and they get sunk to the bottom of the lake or the river. What that leads to is an 8-issue-long sub-story involving Quinn, Venom, and Snake Eyes escaping from the bunker, Dr. Venom doing a whole bunch of double crosses, Snake Eyes is removed from, you know, the Joes. The Joes think he's dead. There's a moving moment where the Joes are going to rescue. The main team is setting up to rescue some of the other Joes that were in Sierra, Gordo, Stalker, and I forget the other two. But and so they're doing a rescue effort for like 3 people. Snake Eyes isn't mentioned, and of course Scarlet approaches Hawk and she said, hey, you said 3 people. She's like, what about Snake Eyes? And Hawk doesn't really answer her, and we see her walking away and there's a teardrop, and that's our first indication that maybe there's something between Scarlet and Snake Eyes that we don't quite know about yet. What follows then is a road trip, right? Quinn and Snake Eyes just traveling the world together.
Yeah. It's sort of what I was dubbing it, the catch and release storyline, because they would get caught, they escape, they'd get caught again, they'd escape, they'd get caught again, they escape.
Numerous times.
Yeah, it's over and over again, but I love it. It's fantastic. It's interesting to see their dynamic. Snake Eyes, of course, doesn't say a word the entire time, and Quinn narrates. Won't shut up. I know, Quinn won't shut up, but he sort of narrates for him. Mm-hmm. What do you mean, Shadow Man? Oh, I believe this is what you mean. It's very entertaining. I did find it a little far-fetched at first when they get arrested in Florida and they're put in jail. And I thought, you know, these are two, you know, high profile military guys. And well, one's a mercenary and one's part of the secret organization. How could they remain locked up? And then I realized, oh, it's Florida. It makes perfect sense.
It's a South American country all of its own.
Exactly. They don't actually have law down there, do they?
And the fact that Snake Eyes just gets to keep his mask on, but it's this ongoing sequence, and like you said, it this would make a great movie, the Quinn and Snake Eyes show.
Well, there is a Snake Eyes movie coming out, you know that.
Yeah, but they're basically on a quest for vengeance against Dr. Venom and also Scarface, because Dr. Venom has tried to kill them numerous times. And it just, and Quinn just won't stop talking about, like, the, what is it, the weasel in his belly.
Yes, the weasel spirits.
Dr. Venom has a weasel in his belly.
I've had that problem myself, but, you know, a little Pepto clears that right up.
There's pills you can take.
It was a very sweet moment, I thought, when Snake Eyes does send a message to the Joes to tell them that he's still alive. Right. And the way that they know it's not a fake message is because of the postscript, which we don't get to see, written directly to Scarlet. So they know it must be true.
Yeah. And Scarlet confirms only Snake Eyes could know this. And we're like, oh yeah, they're stopping.
Only Snake Eyes could know this, except now everyone else, because he wrote it down. for everyone to see.
So. Well, Hawk knows.
Oh, Hawk. Is there anything he doesn't know?
I don't know.
Hawk would know. Now, it starts to get more clear in these later issues. But in the beginning, or maybe this was just me, but a lot of the Joes just sort of were so similar. I know one of them had blonde hair and one of them had a beard, but they were all just sort of, they ran together. I kept having to say, okay, now who's this one? I don't know who this
guy is. Which one is this one?
Yeah. But it seems like in the later issues, you know, Hama has finally said, yeah, we're going to focus on Scarlet. We're going to focus on Snake Eyes, Clutch for some reason. Yeah. Hawk, of course, because he's the leader. And then we have the introduction of Gung-Ho.
And Gung-Ho gets a lot of, let's call it screen time as well.
Yeah.
And I liked Gung-Ho. I like that character.
Doc gets some play as well.
Right. But he also visually, they're more, visually the characters start standing out more.
Right, exactly. And then they all start to be very specific.
Just all in green.
Right, they exactly.
You could tell it was Breaker because he was always chewing gum and blowing bubbles. Otherwise, he looked no different than Clutch. Except Clutch always had the 5 o'clock shadow.
Who's the scuba diver? Because he's introduced really quickly as for underwater assignments. And then Torpedo. The next issue, they're all going on a mission. It's like, well, where's Torpedo? It's like, we're not doing any underwater stuff. He's not coming.
But
he's a very specific G.I. Joe.
But there's also a scene with Torpedo where I think it's when they were attacking the Mint. So there's an issue where Cobra is trying to put the plague onto the money that the Mint is making. And Torpedo is one of the Joes sent to the Mint to stop Cobra from, you know, their nefarious plans. For reasons that I don't know, because there's no water, but Torpedo is one of the characters there. So he's running around on the surface, like on solid ground, still wearing his flippers.
Yes, he's really good at running in those flippers.
He's got his flippers on through the whole thing.
You know that's got to be hilarious if it was in live action. Just flop, 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 flop.
Again, this goes back to, I appreciate that Larry Hama, you know, was primarily tasked with introducing new characters. And, you know, and some of them he introduces and they don't, you know, they're there for, you know, a few panels and then they go away. Some of them have broader uses.
Yeah. Yeah. A character like Torpedo, you need him for bath time.
Right.
You know, you need a G.I. Joe that can swim in your bath with you.
But again, Hama had to create stories that would introduce new characters into the equation so that Hasbro could sell their product. That's got to be kind of difficult, but somehow he was able to write fascinating storylines mm-hmm. while still, you know,
while still telling his own story.
Yeah.
I think he was given a task and he exceeded what he was meant to do. And I think, yeah, definitely Larry Hama is the reason this thing lasted as long as it did.
Absolutely. You know? And things get really complex, even more complex down the line. And I think his writing hones even further. I mean, we made fun of some of the stuff like the toxin stuff and whatever, but you know, again, that's him trying to shoehorn in his Hasbro responsibilities with his desire to write a compelling story.
Yeah.
And I think we really see that with these issues. We didn't cover a lot of what happened in these issues, but I kind of want to move forward a little bit. So all of this and all of these first 18 issues basically are leading up to issue 19, which is kind of a culmination and a reset of some sort. And this is when, you know, we've referred to the fact this is when Cobra attacks the G.I. Joe base. And I do want to mention, I thought it was really groovy that when they were, we see the Joes building this fake fortress, this fake, you know, base that they're going to trick Cobra into thinking is the actual base. And on the front of it is the G.I. Joe logo.
Branding. It's all about branding.
It's all about branding. I was like, that's what they have time to do. You know, it's, and the fact that they actually have a logo, that the G.I. Joe, military G.I. Joe team has a logo that they're going to put on front of their fortress, just in case the postman can't find it.
Yeah, exactly.
It leads up to this massive battle, which eventually leads to the death of Dr. Venom, Scarface, General Flag, who's kind of the, we haven't really mentioned General Flag, but he's the head honcho of it all.
It's funny because it's touted in the issue as a beloved member of the team dies.
Right.
I was like, General Flag, he's the beloved member? Okay, sure, okay.
And, of course, Quinn dies. It's interesting, the Quinn death is, of course, he finally is about to exact his revenge on Dr. Venom and decides he won't, so he pulls a pin out of a grenade and he's holding it. And he finally, Quinn is always kind of giving off this mystical mumbo jumbo and, the great bear and the weasel in the stomach and all of that stuff. And then he finally decides he's not going to kill Dr. Venom. And so he tells Venom, as long as I live, I will not kill you. And he turns to walk away. And of course, Venom shoots him in the back.
Because he's evil.
Because he's evil. So as Quinn falls dead, he drops the grenade, which bounces over and blows up.
Yes.
Well, before it happens, Dr. Venom has that great villain moment where he's like, a grenade from a dead man's hands. And then he gets blown up real good.
Blown up real good. So is Quinn actually dead? Now, I haven't actually read on, but he seems like a character that might come back at some point.
He remains a very popular character.
So should I take that as he lives?
But he didn't have a toy.
He didn't have a toy?
Not at the time. I haven't kept up with what toys were made like since then. What I can tell you is Scarface, Dr. Venom, General Flag, and Quinn did not have toys.
It's funny how the ones without toys all died.
Right.
That's it. I'm sure that was just a coincidence.
Right. But the ones with toys
all lived. They have toy armor.
Quinn was at the time all Larry Hama's creation for the comic. I think that he was probably supposed to be a one and done for issue two, but was so popular that Larry Hama brought him back. So the culmination of that is Snake Eyes finally returns, finally gets back to the Joes and is reunited with everybody. But of course, the last panel is, they're all celebrating because the Joes, Cobra blew up the fake fortress and took off, but the Joes are celebrating because it was mission accomplished. Now Cobra thinks that they destroyed the Joe base so they can continue to have the base where it is. Then they just kind of look off panel, like towards us, and they're like, hey, why the long faces, fellas? It was a mission complete. And then you see Doc's hand holding General Flag's dog tags, and Snake Eyes' hand holding Quinn's, he had a necklace of skulls or a necklace of whatever.
So it ends on a sad note.
It ends on a sad note.
But that is sort of a resolution to the whole arc that's been happening since.
Right. And And some things carry on into later issues. But it kind of wraps things up. And then the next issue, we get a story about Clutch, which is, I don't care about. Do you care about?
Nope. Moving on.
A Clutch solo story, whoopee, and then we get to issue 21.
And issue 21 is rightfully lauded as a classic.
So issue 21, it's the silent issue. Most people listening to this podcast know about this issue, but it's the
I had never read the comic and I knew about this issue,
right?
So there you go.
It's considered very, it's very seminal. Other silent comics have been done before, but mostly independent. And even Scott McCloud, the comic scholar, has cited it as, one of the most important issues. But it's a comic with no words. And I remember when I first got it and I was looking at the cover, and I was just like, oh, yes, it's going to be about Snake Eyes. And I start reading it, and I didn't know it was when you first read it, nobody knew it was going to be a silent issue, right? Everybody just
even though it was called Silent Interlude.
Silent Interlude is called, and the whole comic is done without any dialogue, any thought balloons, any panels. There is literally not a single word in the entire issue.
There is one. There's no spoken. There's no sound effects. There is a couple of things like where you read a dossier.
Oh, right. A printout. Destro looks at a computer screen and then.
Right. But that's it as far as explanations.
But none of those are sound. And of course, what this does is it's mirroring the fact that Snake Eyes can't speak. Now, you know that there's sound going on. You know that Destro's talking and Scarlet's talking. And
it's great. It is a genius issue of visual storytelling. I mean, you're not confused. You know exactly what's going on at all times. It's fantastic. It tells the story of Scarlet being captured by Cobra and Snake Eyes.
But by who? Remember who Scarlet, like Scarlet is captured by Storm Shadow.
Who I didn't know at the time. I know that character just from like I said, from the periphery. But when he showed up in the comic, I was like, oh, it's this guy. Was Storm Shadow huge at the time? Or was this his first introduction?
This was his first introduction.
Right on.
Okay. Yeah, this is the first appearance of Storm Shadow, who would prove to be almost as popular, if not equal in popularity, to Snake Eyes.
Which is interesting that Snake Eyes, the good guy, wears black.
And Storm Shadow
wears white.
Well, we're also assuming that Storm Shadow is actually... Storm Shadow is a very complex character. And as we see in the final panels of the comic, may have a further connection to Snake Eyes.
See, this you're hinting at stuff that I have no idea about.
Well, no, but you, this is like in the comic. You caught their arms.
Yes, yes.
They had the same tattoo. That's what I'm talking about. But essentially, what the comic is it's a rescue mission. It's Scarlet gets kidnapped by the Storm Shadow, and she's taken to this castle, an ominous looking castle, and Destro is around in this castle as well. Of course, then we have Snake Eyes coming in on a plane, and I think when Destro looks at that computer screen, and he sees that something is coming.
Something has breached their defenses.
Yeah. Right, and the percentage of success for that for the person on jumping out of the plane to actually reach the castle was like 5% or 10%. But it's Snake Eyes, so of course he makes it.
Exactly.
So Snake Eyes is coming to rescue Scarlet. Scarlet gets loose. I mean, it's a simple story.
Yeah.
Scarlet also gets loose. And so she and Snake Eyes, not together, but separately throughout the castle, are fighting Destro. And Snake Eyes ends up fighting Storm Shadow. And then the Hand shows up.
Daredevil is suddenly there.
It's not the Hand, but they are ninjas in red.
Yeah.
And so Snake Eyes is fighting all of them. And
wait, it's not the Imperial Guard?
It's not the Imperial Guard.
Ah, darn. Okay.
Some point, finally, Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow are facing off. Storm Shadow gets ready to throw his sword to kill Snake Eyes. Scarlet has like some kind of...
It's a winged jetpack.
Winged jetpack. She lands in front of Snake Eyes to save him, just as the sword is being thrown. And she is about to save, sacrifice her life to save Snake Eyes. Then Snake Eyes, because he is the baddest of the bad, catches the sword in both of his hands.
Very cool moment.
He jumps on the back of Scarlet. They fly off. Storm Shadow's the wrappings on his arm have come off, and he has a tattoo with a kind of a line and dashes. Then it shows Snake Eyes, who has a cut on in his uniform, and it shows that he also has the exact same tattoo,
which is intriguing for the future. And again, this is why I wanted to read on a little bit to, read more about Snake Eyes, basically. But this issue, and I've read a little bit about it, at the time, was not beloved. It was seen as being a cheat that they didn't have, there was no words. And it was a comic that you couldn't read it because they were cheating. And
I think it was more mixed than that.
Okay. But it's just amazing to me that, something this, that has become seminal, and even someone like me who has never read G.I. Joe knew about this issue. I guess my point to that, maybe we shouldn't be so quick to judge something at first glance and let it reveal itself over time.
That's crazy talk.
I know.
One of the things to note is that it was Larry Hama did the breakdowns. Then the great Steve, and I'm going to mispronounce his name because I always do, Steve Lealoha. And then Steve did the finishes.
There you go.
You can cut and paste that. Have fun editing.
It's all good.
Did the finishes, but it's as a piece of sequential art. Like it's not just about the story that it's telling in a silent manner. It's as a piece of sequential art. It's really, really well done. It's I wonder. I haven't really read on Hama's thought process as he was doing this. Was he doing the layouts at the same time he was plotting it? I don't know.
it's incredibly well done. I mean, like you said, there have been other silent issues before or silent segments of a story, you know.
But this is a massive, huge, monster, mainstream comic from Marvel selling toys.
Yeah, I wonder what Hasbro's idea on this was.
By all accounts, they kind of left well enough alone. Because Hama was also working with them in the creation of the toys and the characters. Because we had, you remember, like, when you, well, you didn't get the toys, but the toys always had, like, the classified information on the back, like, you know, on the card. So, and Hama was writing those. So, from what I read, Hasbro was very much hands-off. I mean, I think if he stopped introducing their toys constantly, they might have been like, hey, now. But I think they were incredibly pleased with the amount of toys they were selling because of this comic. I have no idea if Hama actually had to submit his scripts to Hasbro in advance. Certainly doesn't seem like, there's probably, we could probably find that out there, but I think it's also worth noting, maybe this should have been said at the beginning, you did catch who the editor of the comic was, right?
I thought it was Shooter. Denny O'Neill. Oh, it was Denny O'Neill.
Denny O'Neill was the editor.
You know what? I didn't catch that. I just assumed it was Jim Shooter.
Well, he's the editor-in-chief.
Right, yeah. So but Denny O'Neill. The actual
editor on it was Denny O'Neill.
Oh, right on.
So you had an editor who was very much pro-creator and also very much pro-experimentation. Experimentation and what have you. It feels as if maybe there was a confluence of having a really great editor. It's still weird to think of Denny O'Neill editing G.I. Joe.
Yeah, for sure.
It was a combination of so many things, and I just... I can go back and read or look at this comic over and over and over again. And I'm trying to remember my initial reaction to it when I first read it. And I think I was okay with it, partly because it was Snake Eyes and Scarlet, and it was a Storm Shadow who was a ninja and other ninjas. And the fact that there were no words, I got over that really quickly.
There's a visual language to it. There's a, yes. You know, there is a narrative that can be, you know, read, quote unquote, read. And it's fantastic. You know, this is a great example of, you know, what comics can do well.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a unique medium. We've talked about this before, and it's weird that we're talking about this on a G.I. Joe comic, which I will always enjoy, even though, like, some of it's absurd. But comics are absurd at some point, or at least I meant that as a compliment. We'll move on. But it's such a powerful medium in that it has bits of film, it has bits of visual art, it has bits of literature all going into the creation of this thing. And I'm not trying to say that comics are fine art or that they're Citizen Kane or that they're Ulysses or, you know, Mark Twain or whatever.
They can be.
But yes, they can be. I think this is one of those issues, came out of nowhere. It's an action issue, but I think that it's important on a number of levels that we've already talked about, but it's good storytelling, and it's good storytelling in a way that other mediums can't always do.
Exactly. And, you know, comic books, you know, yes, they are inherently silly, and there's goofiness in a lot of their presentation, but it's such a unique medium that it lends itself to experimentation and avant-garde kind of. And again, for me saying avant-garde in association with G.I. Joe sounds ridiculous, but that's what this is. And it's a testament to how good comic books can be, even in the most ridiculous, silly situations.
Yeah.
They can be something, you know, artful. It takes a lot to get here, but once you get here, it's worth the ride.
Yeah. I mean, you have to, again, it's, I love these comics as a kid. Rereading them now, I haven't read them in a long, long time. But what's funny is, as you know, because I'm reading them in digital files now, and it was so weird because I remember, like I'm 7 or 8 or something, or 10. I think I was 10 when it first came out. That sounds about right. Getting close to being too old to be reading G.I. Joe, but and getting toys, but not quite there yet. You know what I mean? And
you mean now? You're getting right now. You're getting close.
Right
to being
now,
too old.
I am getting. Too old.
you're getting close to being too old to read G.I. Joe.
I've been known to pick up a toy now and again, but
I know what you say. I mean, you still, even if you're, you know, thinking you're too old for it, it's still pretty good. I am reading this for the first time in my 50s, and I still enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a comic. This is a comic meant for children in the 1980s specifically, and it's still an enjoyable comic.
And I think what I was trying to think of earlier is, you know, as a, like, I read this like a 10 years old, maybe reread it several times through the next few years. But when I was rereading it now, which I haven't read since, you know, in a good 25, 30 years, probably, I remembered everything. I remembered the covers. I remembered certain scenes. I remembered it was really strange. But then that's, you know, I do that when I go back and read, you know, the Avengers comics that I love so much that had the Beast and Wonder Man, because those were my first Avengers comics in the late 70s, early 80s. And I go back and reread those. And it's like, I remember this stuff.
I remember we just did Godzilla, and I read that when I was a kid. And I remember we were just picking up the digital files, and I was like, oh, I remember this cover. Oh, I remember how ridiculous that is. Yeah, these things stick with you.
And that's comics, you know, and people get that from other mediums as well. I mean, I could probably quote the entirety of Casablanca if need be. I've seen it so many times, and
I literally can't, like, Holy Grail, Monty Python, the Holy Grail. I literally can recite that start to finish, mostly doing all the voices as well.
People could do that with Rocky Horror Picture Show or
Star Wars.
Yeah. So, jeez. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's really weird that we're talking like about this at the end of a discussion on G.I. Joe. but it is, you know, and we didn't go deep into the plot of these comics, and I don't think it was really necessary. We maybe could have talked about some of the other characters a little bit more, but we didn't, and that's okay. But it is, it's one of those weird things where you remember a thing being kind of silly, and you're like, that's my youth, and that's a silly comic book about the military, and I'm not in my life interested in military stuff in any way, shape, or form. But then I go back and read it, and I remember that there's some good writing in there, and there's some good comics being made there. And you know, I think that's fun.
It is fun. And, you know, and thank you for recommending this, because this is not something I would have chosen to go and read. You know, I wouldn't think, oh man, my comics knowledge is lacking because I haven't read G.I. Joe. That would never occur to me. But having, you know, I don't want to say having been forced to, but because I had to go back and read this, I mean, it's not something I would have chosen, but I'm glad I did, because this was a very entertaining comic, and it's not one of the genres of comics that I would have chosen to read. But I like I said, I'm glad I did, because it was very entertaining, and it's, you know, I don't want to say it's opened my mind to new horizons, but
no, it certainly hasn't.
No.
I remember I gave you an option of two comics, and this was one of them, and you voted for this one.
Because I hadn't read it. I want new stuff. Well, new old stuff. But no, I could, having read this, I can see why it was popular. I understand why the Joe zeitgeist happened. And, you know, I didn't enjoy every aspect of this comic, but overall, like I said, I was never bored, you know, and I was compelled to keep, to this point, I do want to keep going to find out what happens to Snake Eyes. So I can totally see why this became popular and why it continued as long as it did. But overall, thank you for recommending this, because I did enjoy it quite a bit.
I'm glad that you found some enjoyment in it, even in some of the ridiculousness of it. You know, real American hero. And speaking of American heroes, Paul, you are an American hero. And would you like to tell us what your recommendation for the next comic will be?
If you mean I'm a sandwich, I could be a real American hero. But
if you were a sandwich and a real American hero, you'd be Hoagie Carmichael.
That was incredibly cheesy.
I'm sorry, I was just hamming it up.
Okay. On the next edition of the Collected Edition, we will be reading Master of Kung Fu, Weapon of the Soul. Featuring, of course, Shang-Chi. This is an epic collection, and it collects 19 issues from multiple comics. Marvel Special Edition, Master of Kung Fu, Giant-Size Master of Kung Fu, Giant-Size Spider-Man, and Iron Man. All these comics combined in this epic collection basically tell the origins of Shang-Chi. And it features creators such as Steve Englehart, Doug Monk, Jim Starlin, Jerry Conway, Len Wein, and Roger Stern, among others.
My goodness, that's a who's who.
That's a who's who of Marvel at the time. So I think this will be a good, you know, primer for the upcoming movie. And it's more 70s Marvel goodness. Oh, we're pretty Marvel heavy recently.
We're going to have to shake that. Yeah,
probably shake that up a little bit, but not this time. I do believe you'll get a kick out of this.
Oh.
Thank you. So that's it. Thank you all for listening. As always, we'd love to hear your feedback. Leave a comment on our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where you can leave comments on our individual episode or go to Twitter, collectededpod, that's collected EDPOD, to talk to us directly.
Or Paul.
So until next time, again, thanks for listening and keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the program are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. If you'd like to give us your feedback, the show can be found online at our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes, or send us an email to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes